Well, where were we?
I would like to know who the people are making contributions to this effort. The same group as in Renaissance One.
Well, it's
Melons, Hines, and
well, it's largely a new generation, of course. I mean, you find that the people who were here, obviously, in the 1940s and 50s, have long since retired, and all too many of them are no longer with us. I'm one of the sole survivors because I apparently. Well, you still have a very active interest by Jack Hines, H.J. Hines II, in particular. And Jack was young enough to go back to the First Renaissance and survive and flourish in the Second. And Henry Hillman, who was a young man, served on one of the early Urban Redevelopment Authority boards, is still very much concerned. And both of them have the advantage of having foundations, which their families have created. So they have they're not only important in what they make to themselves, they're important in the resource base. And you still find the R.K. Mellon Foundation, which of course memorializes R.K. Mellon, who was a business leader in the First Renaissance, is still here and very helpful to us. Other than that, the corporate leadership changes about every 5 or 7 years. I mean, a man normally becomes the CIO of a company, let's say, in his late 50s, and he retires at 65. So you get a changing of the guard over time. But I think it's become a custom, really, and almost an obligation for the corporate leaders here to participate in the conference. I can't think of anyone that does not. And of course, it's by invitation. The board decides that they want to add to their group. So you do find naturally the same companies. We've been fortunate in Pittsburgh that not many of our companies have been conglomerated. Most of them are still the major factor in their industry or have remained free from outside control. And so they continue as they were. Copper, Gulf, and Alcoa, U.S. Steel, National Steel, the Mellon Bank, and Pittsburgh National Bank, Duquesne Light, all the companies that we knew over the years are still very active, obviously, to report what they do here. And a few of us, like Bob Pease and myself, Bill Fralick, who was at the Regional Planning, Southwestern Pennsylvania Planning Commission, and there are a few of us left who were still there. Young men were active years ago who are still either been brought back or are still active.
Gives continuity.
Some continuity, yeah.
How do you spell Mr. Fralick's name?
In the most complicated way you can.
F-R-O-E-H-L-I-C-H. Thank you.
Do the goals differ in Renaissance 2 from Renaissance 1?
And well, the basic goal does not differ, which is how do you stabilize and improve Pittsburgh as an urban center. The methods change, of course, and there's a much wider participation by many more organizations and actors, and a greater sophistication, I think, in both the public bodies, the private bodies, and the general public. Things go probably more slowly. We're more concerned and we're more knowledgeable in urban design, and the quality of our architecture will be better. And so I think it's building on the past, but I think adjusted to the present.
What is the mayor's role? Does it compare in any way with David Lyons?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, the mayor in the city of Pittsburgh, we have what is called a strong mayor form of government, and the mayor is really the chief executive of the city and has great control over what the city will do. The mayor sets the tone, really, of what he wants his administration to achieve. He selects the people who have the job of carrying it out, and depending on his personality, he's either receptive to ideas from outside, as Mayor Calgieri is, or he's exclusive of them, as Mayor Fiery was. And much of this could not happen without the mayor's interest and cooperation, and essentially the leadership that he provides. We've been fortunate, I think. He's assembled a very excellent staff. He's got some very able people. David Matter, M-A-T-T-R, who is his executive secretary, is a man of very unusual ability and really represents the mayor in most of these activities. Paul Brophy, who is our executive director of the Redevelopment Authority, is a very able and again, young man of this generation who is both a competent government official and a very receptive again, and originator of good new ideas. Bob Lurcott, city planning, and an excellent planner. So I think you have an excellent group of people, probably stronger than we had 40 years ago. It's a different, again, a different generation. At that time, much of the leadership had to come from outside the direct city government. This time, it's well within it.
Can I ask,
sure.
Did you play any role in any of these elections? Were you consulted?
Yes, mm-hmm. In this, two respects, I suppose. I originally was among those who recommended that Paul Brophy be housing director and helped convince him he should. And also, I think we, at the conference, Brophy, well, myself, but more Brophy's and myself because of his position to do so, made it possible for Dave Matter to feel that he could leave his job that he had at community college
mm-hmm.
and join Mayor Caligiuri in the government here. He was worried about what would happen to him in the future, obviously. He wanted some assurances that he would be remembered if he took that risk. So I think also the other thing I did suggest, which has worked well, was the creation of what we call the Mayor's Development Council, which Matter chairs, and it meets every Thursday in the mayor's office. And we've stolen a precept from the conference that the people on that council have to come themselves. They can't send delegates. And that means that the people in the city government, and somewhat outside the city government as well, meet every Thursday to make sure that they're kept aware in what other people are doing, and major projects are discussed and advice taken. Of course, in the end, like in many of these things, the mayor, at least through Dave Matter, has all the votes when he wants them. But seriously, it's a very good effort to make sure that nothing slips mm-hmm. and everybody gets it. So we, and on that, we have the Redevelopment Authority, the Planning Department, the Parking Authority, the Port Authority, which although it's a county agency, the Regional Industrial Development Corporation, the Parks Director, the Finance Director, and the Works Director of the city. These are the people who together pretty much mm-hmm. determine whether how things go and have the responsibility carrying or not.
Mm-hmm.
So those meetings have been very fruitful.
They meet in the mayor's office?
They meet in the mayor's office at 8 o'clock every mm-hmm. Thursday and meet till 10. And there's an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kept things, I think, moving as they should. It's turned out to be quite useful.
Are there any of Pittsburgh architects involved in some of the buildings under construction?
A great many. Let me think. They complain that they don't get the biggest jobs, but mm-hmm. I'm sure many other when a Pittsburgh architect gets a job in Cincinnati, they probably complain, why did he get that job? It's still one country. Well, it's a bit invidious to name any individual, but there's an effort made to involve Pittsburgh
architects. This is what I wanted.
Yeah. And we really want them to. And I won't try to name individuals.
Yeah.
If you look at the Allegheny Conference and Urban Development reports, you'll see who there is.
You referred a while back to the Civic Arena as being slated for some renovation. Is this too part of Renaissance 2?
Well, Renaissance 2 becomes
all-inclusive.
A rubric. Yeah, you put everything there. Well, it's a proposal was developed during this administration that the DeBarlo interest suggested to the city and county that they would take over the arena and assume the debt that the arena had and assume all responsibility for future maintenance and repairs. And it's probably a good deal. They also took an option on the land above the civic arena, which is called the Melody 10 mm-hmm. site, and they have 5 years to come forward with a development plan for that area. We hope they do. And, of course, there is a problem. What we're getting to now, though, you know, many of the things were built 30 years ago are just like some of the rest of us are starting to wear.
Time started.
Yeah. And Mellon Square needs a new face. And the stadium needs a lot of repair. Mm-hmm. The Civic Arena does. And so, I mean, you just have to know that after 20 or 30 years, you have to come back and bring it back to proper shape.
Any other general observations, Mr. Robin, on Renaissance 2 and what effect it will have on Pittsburgh?
Well, the hope that you have is that it will keep Pittsburgh as a flourishing city. As a matter of fact, somewhat more flourishing probably than many of the older cities in the Northeast and the Middle West. We've had to make what would have been a traumatic adjustment to the change in the steel industry and other basic manufacturing. I mean, if you look back at what Pittsburgh was 50 years ago, we were based on coal and steel
industry.
And heavy industry. And heavy industry is no longer the major part of the country's economy. And again, the plants that were built 50 and 75 years ago, we were just talking about obsolescence. They've become older and they're not normally then efficient. So if we had not been able to change the character of Pittsburgh by the amenities that have been introduced here, by the maintenance of major corporate headquarters here, and by the development of our educational and recreational amenities, we could have been a slumping mill town. And also, I think that, fortunately, Pittsburgh, and this you have to give credit to Pete Clarity as well as to Cal Geary, the mayors here in the city council have been determined not to get over their heads in debt. And they've been, whether it's pleasant or not, they've levied enough taxes to keep the city solvent, unlike Cleveland and New York and other cities which have gotten in very deep trouble from time to time. But I feel that unless we're entering a period of prolonged economic recession, which everyone hopes we're not, I think that you'll find that Pittsburgh in 10 years, or even in 5 years, will be a very much more attractive city. It is now, and today it's a lot better than it was in the 1930s. So I would think that what we really, the best you can hope to do is achieve some kind of stability and continuity and make yourself, those who come after you, feel secure in being part of the Pittsburgh community.
I'd like to ask you a question about the funding problem.
Yeah.
And how you seem to, or the conference seem to have kept the corporation's interest in plowing the money back into the city.
Well, they...
When there's so many other tempting things.
Nobody in the conference, of course, can tell any member of the conference, you go build a building. I mean, that's something they have to make as a corporate decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think the conference has been able to create an atmosphere in which they have confidence in the city and in themselves, and even and when they decide to make it, if an expansion is economically desirable, then they're willing to make it here. And it increases the interest that they have and the hold they have. Now, that's a part of the Russian Foundation funds, which are set up to be given away. And I think the fact that we've had a number of important foundations in Pittsburgh, Heinz, the Buell, the various Mellon family foundations, have been a source of money. Not always a huge amount, well, sometimes a huge amount, a large amount of money, particularly to the universities. Many years ago, the Graduate School of Public Health here hit with a $13,500,000 grant from the Mellon Foundation. Mellon's Park was a $4 million grant from the Mellon Foundation. Station Square got $6.5 million from the Scape Foundation. So these things are represent the accumulated earnings rather than, of course, the current operations of Pittsburgh business. So when a company like PPG or U.S. Steel decides to build a new headquarters building, they obviously do several things. First, I think in conscience they say, well, we better have somebody in to survey what our choices are, and they get some professional surveys made. And then they do what they were going to do in the first place.
However, did you have any role in solving that conflict between the merchants and PPG?
Not directly. The URA did. But I was not involved in the actual negotiations. And there, of course, the problem was time. If we had had enough time, to advise you to things out in the courts, I have no doubt in my mind what the decision would have been.
Which is?
Which would have been to uphold the authority and what we did. On the other hand, in a period of inflation, any month you lose runs into, well, a year it runs into tens of millions in a $150 million project. So in the end, I think the parties wore themselves down, and I think the merchants who were in protest ended up very well. Dave Bender says we made a crop of instant millionaires. Yeah, that's true. Someone talking about other people. You somehow, oh, what I would think, were outrageous prices were paid, but it was a necessity of the time.
It did make everyone happy.
And then everybody finally happy, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you're at a disadvantage today more than ever. And when you have a big enterprise, whether it's a corporation or a government, and on one side, and a small businessman or a farmer or somebody on this side, because on television, you can't win. I mean, obviously, sympathy always goes to, and even if he doesn't have a good legal case, or if he's been made, you know, what other people might think a fair offer, the sentiment rolls, obviously, to the person who is putting himself up against the governmental juggernaut. So you have to think about that, too. And we're somewhat different in that respect than we used to.
I'd really like to hear your techniques of how these problems are solved. It sounds as if you have a certain style.
Well, that's something I have been, I think, fairly successful at over the years in many areas, perhaps in my contribution. I'm trying to get reasonable people to agree on reasonable solutions. And the feeling that you're not always right and play everything out to the last ditch. And the people who are opposed to you are basically malevolent and evil, and you don't want to have anything to do with them. And there's usually a place where both parties, if the project is sound, I mean, if the project is a non-sound project, it ought not to go through, it ought not to be constructed. But I have been involved in a number of reconciliations on strong conflicts, like the one about the Port Authority of the Skybus, the LRT, and then I was once active in creating a compact on the Delaware River, which had been a 100-year argument between New York and Pennsylvania, and a few things like that. It's a question of patience and a question and a belief of all parties that you're attempting to be fair. And I think that if you can make it clear that you are attempting to be fair, then reasonable people will usually come to a conclusion. And tiring people out.
That question of endurance.
They're sticking with the issue. Yeah.
In just a one sentence, could you tell us about the Delaware River?
Well, I can't say about the one sentence. That's a long one.
Oh,
did
that occur?
That occurred when I was in Philadelphia primarily.
You did cover that. I was going to cover that.
On the whole, you have a very optimistic outlook on the future of Pittsburgh.
Well, only with the exception of what this national recession is likely to do and how long it will last. If we recover from the recession, I think we'll be able to do everything we plan to do and do it very well. If you're going to be in a period of interest rates of 16.5% prime, and if you don't have a new demand for consumption in the economy, then how many more hotels can you have? How many more office buildings do you have? How many more houses? Well, we know we're not building any houses. So, I mean, really, so I would say that if and when the national economy rights itself, I think Pittsburgh will be right in line to do quite well. We have all the instruments here, and I think the ideas and the people, so, but we can't control the rate of inflation, we can't control the growth of the economy, we can't control interest rates. I mean, those are things you have to wait to see what the national and international effects are.
Well, let's hope that all the goals of Renaissance 2 are realized.
Okay, well, one of the things I'm trying to do is have a big party here in 1986, Renaissance Festival. So you're in town. You're right with her too.
You have that on tape now. I have it on tape. I'll hold you to that.
Okay. Well, we'll put you to work.
Very good. Briefly, Mr. Robin, could we return to a few more observations on your personal life as well as life of the Pittsburgh community? Your daughter, you stated she attended the University of Pennsylvania when you were living there. Did she also go to law school there?
No, she went to Georgetown.
I see. I don't believe we got her birthday.
Her birthday was September 28th.
We're not going to tell her you hesitated.
Yeah. I was thinking my son, February 10th. September 28th,
1942. You indicated, I believe, that she was divorced. Are there any
yes.
children?
No. Unfortunately, it looks like I'm leaving no grandchildren.
I see. And she is practicing law?
She's practicing law in Northern Virginia.
I see. And your son, you said he did attend Pitt.
He graduated University of Pittsburgh and served in the Army. And then since that time, worked in Philadelphia at various business jobs.
I see.
Nothing very spectacular.
He had no particular area of interest?
Well, his personal interest is a hobby of the season. One of the early experts in currency, not from the standpoint of depositing in the bank.
Collecting.
Collecting.
Coin collecting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is he married?
Yes, he's married.
Could you contrast the way you were raised with the way you raised your children? Was your family a more cohesive unit?
No, I don't think so. I think not. Of course, my children are only two, mm-hmm. and we were a family of five with a much larger, wider age gap. It was 4 years between Peter and Anne. But they were always very friendly and very close and still are. And my own upbringing had been largely independent. I'd found my own way to do things. And I think our kids pretty much the same way. We were very relatively little parental interference and as much guidance as they wanted. And that's about it. And an opportunity, obviously, for an education. But the choice of career completely, and no attempt to push them into doing whatever I thought. I mean, sort of Peter had gone up to be a Nobel Prize but the biochemist, I'd be very happy. You can't do that. And Andrew might end up in the Supreme Court. No, seriously. No, we've judged a lot of them, too. And I don't know that I was a particularly good father. I was very busy and had many interests outside the family. And as I said, my natural inclination with other people, my children, anybody else, is you do what you want to do. So I think we're very lucky. They both turned out respectable, right, good people.
That's all you can ask
for. I mean, in this day, I'll tell you this, when you know all the people that have problems with suicides and drug alcohol problems, I consider myself very fortunate.
Did your active career over the years permit the family vacations, that sort of activity?
Oh yes, yeah. I never was to a 9-to-5, 7-day-a-week schedule. Whatever I get to do becomes more or less in spurts. And so when possible, very often we would, my interest. Maybe I was over-dominant in this respect. I'd always say, let's go somewhere on the beach or in the mountains or in the woods or something where you watch birds or likewise. So we, and of course we went, and when I was with the Ford Foundation, when Peter was in the Army, and well, Ansley and Peter, my first wife, came over to live in Calcutta, and they had an opportunity to travel a big deal. That had happened. Peter had 2 years in Germany during the war in the Army, and I used to meet him in Europe occasionally. I would not say that our family is close-knit. I'd say it's affectionate, but independent.
As to your hobbies, I know that you're a bird watcher, and I read in a recent Carnegie Museum publication that you donated your 750 ornithology libraries.
Well, the actual number is 583.
Oh, well, they said 750.
Well, that included the in-print books, which I'm holding. But I suppose, I don't know where they got the 750.
Nevertheless, that's quite a hobby.
It is quite a hobby.
A collection like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was a very good collection. But that really reflected not my interest in the books, although that ultimately became an interest. It really originally reflected my interest in the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And, no, I've been interested in, I guess my basic hobbies or principal interests, which have been lifelong, really have been in wildlife, in nature, particularly birds, because they're most visible, would be attractive. And in history, and in travel, which relates often to history. Anthropology, which relates to travel, too. These are the things I would have studied when I was younger. Career has been open. And in food and wine.
Gourmet cooking, I'm told.
Well, I've given that up now because it's become too common.
My
theory is you these things are all, it's like reading, you don't buy bestsellers. You see, when everybody else decides to do fancy cooking and drink,
then you turn to other fields.
Then you live on ham and eggs.
Not exclusive. Let's stop here and turn the tape over.
Yeah.